Welcome to the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show, presented by Hugh Hattrick. Drive fast and try not to crash.
Good evening and welcome to the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show with me, Hugh Hattrick, and my co-host Andrew Marr, and my other co-host Jonathan Sutherland, and my very, very special guest, Adam Croft. It's great to see you.
Hi, guys.
Good to see you, Adam. And of course, Adam is from simtrack.co.uk. And if you've been watching our little video adverts that I did this morning when I was playing around with some software, I thought I'll put that all together, you may have had a little idea of what Adam does. But now we've got you back on the show. Adam, tell our guests what's been happening with SimTrack. And so someone who might have not heard of SimTrack, what exactly is it that you do?
Okay, so SimTrack launched about 18 months ago with the stated aim of becoming the North's premier race driver training simulator center. So at that time, there was nothing like that in the area. And so we spotted a gap in the market to launch something. And I set it up as a joint venture with Ginetta Cars, which are based just outside of Leeds. And about 20 minutes from where I live. Obviously, lots of obvious synergies in doing that. Huge brand with Ginetta, and massive in the motorsport market, not just in the UK but globally as well. So we set that up 18 months ago. We did it with the very explicit aim of being a driver training centre. So steering clear of the whole gaming side of things, which I'm sure we'll come on and talk about a bit more later on. And we'd had a mega first year and first 18 months. And, you know, if you rewind to sort of January, February time, we were just hitting our stride as we approached the start of the second race season that we'd been operational, really building up ahead of steam and getting ready for the start of the season. And then the dreaded C word hit us and hit us hard, like it has done everybody else. So that's sort of the potted history of where we are. I think you guys came to visit. Was it October, November time?
Yeah,
you guys
October.
Came to visit.
I was going to say, we had a phenomenal, phenomenal afternoon. We could not stop talking all the way back up to Jonathan's and up to Scotland. I was so fired up that night. It was the kind of most real experience, other than being in a racing car on a track, that I've ever had. And being taught with your instructor there, James Kellett. What I learned from there, even just in 10, 15 minutes, was phenomenal. And it's helped me on my, obviously for me as kind of more of a fun gamer, it's definitely helped me get my lap times down. And you've got some amazing stories of real racing drivers coming in to get trained and then going off to do, to win races in the real world right after it.
Absolutely, Hugh. Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think that the benefits of simulators need to be sort of over egged at this point. I think certainly all the young drivers coming through the ranks understand the benefit that simulators can give them, and there's a reason why all the youngsters in Formula One and down through all the ranks of motorsport use them. So that's why it was there's two main players in this market down south who'd very much sort of dominated the marketplace. And because there was nothing like this in the north of England, we wanted to set up something that was a genuine race driver training center. So you're not just turning up to have a play on a computer game for a couple of hours. You're having the one-to-one coaching with professional ARDS qualified coaches. And it's all about honing lap time. It's about improving your skills, working on techniques that might not be able to be worked on at the racetrack. And ultimately, delivering the performance that you can then take to the real world. So that's the whole ethos of everything that we do. Yeah. And to do that, it has to be as realistic as possible. So for that reason, you're sat in a proper race car cockpit. We've actually got two different cockpits. We've got a GT3 car, which is full sort of paddle shift gear experience. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a Ginetta G40 cockpit, which anyone that follows the Ginetta ladder will know that's what the juniors race in. It's also where a lot of the amateur race drivers start out. So that's more of a sort of a club or entry level race car, mm-hmm. Manual H pattern or sequential shift in that one. And so it does give a very realistic experience of being in the car itself.
Yeah. And of course, going on, you gave an example, I know in our last show, I've had you had the Junita kind of younger drivers coming along to train. Mm. And then when they went to Zandvoort, wasn't it? And they ended up doing incredibly well.
Yeah, they did. Sorry, I completely missed the question that you asked there and just talked about the simulator, didn't I? typical politician's answer. So the drivers we have are, range from the junior drivers coming up through the karting ranks and taking their first steps into proper race cars, right up through to sort of touring car and British GT type level. And there was a great example last year where a number of different championships, including some Ginetta championships, went to Zandvoort in Holland, and it was the first time that most of those drivers on the grid had raced at that track, and the results really spoke for themselves. The guys that had come here, we put a specific Zandvoort boot camp on for that event, so it was literally blocked out a week of time, I think it was, for people just to come and learn that circuit. And the guys that came and did the sessions with us beforehand in the simulator, had the coaching with James, going through the data and video analysis, etc., they just hit the ground running. As soon as they landed at first test session on the Friday, they were out, and they were quickest and dominated the weekend. So
that's amazing, because that's exactly what you want, isn't it, when you think, because you're appealing to the right clientele, and then they come along, they do the practice, they get your all the testing that they do at your facility, and then they go out there and they win. You can't get any better than that. And I think for people who have never maybe raced before, to actually think, well, actually, this is now where it has to be, because how expensive is normal testing? It's thousands and thousands of pounds. So you can provide a facility that can help people learn everything they need to learn from scratch, and then they can be competitive
sort of to put the costs into perspective, if you took something like a Ginetta Super Cup Championship, which we have a number of drivers from, that's like the main support package on the BTCC, you're probably looking at budgets of annual season budgets there of up to £150,000, maybe even more in some cases. And for somewhere between $2,500 to $3,000, you could have a full season of sim time and sim coaching, which obviously is a fraction of that overall budget. It's probably the equivalent of a cost of a set of tyres. So the sort of the incremental seat time that you get by doing that ahead of each race, I'm never going to sit here and say that it takes away from the real world testing. They still have to do that. And, you can never replicate the real thing. But certainly in terms of bang for buck and getting your seat time in and getting you to be as prepared as possible, then it's... it's money well spent for sure.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting, I'll have a quick thing, Jonathan, we can't see you. You look like you're on a Crime Watch back page. You've got no background colour at all. So we need to put some light on, or we've got something from the SES joining us here. But it's that kind of look of, we'll hear your voice, but we can't see you. From our shot that we had back in October there, I did a day at Mercedes at Brooklands and on one of their test tracks. And I have to say, from what I carried from that, because obviously I'm used to doing simulators, and then because James was telling me when to accelerate, when to brake and all of that. Then I had actually a GT driver as an instructor as well alongside me. So it all came right back. And I thought, now I'm actually doing it for real. It was a C43 AMG saloon. But we were really going for it. It just seemed so natural when you actually had a go, because, you're doing left foot braking a little bit and different things, and it just works, and you had the paddle shift and so on and so forth. So it was amazing how what you learn in your simulator really does transfer to making it. I actually felt it was easier in the car. Well, that was compared to like Gran Turismo, but obviously your one is very detailed. But it's amazing how it definitely works.
Well, and that's the thing, we focus on driver techniques, as I say, that we're not about people just sort of turning up and having a blast around for a couple of hours. I mean, they can do that, but there's no real benefit to doing that. So we work very much on technique. We've got all the data, so we can see sort of throttle traces, braking pressures, steering inputs, exactly the way the driver is driving the car. Yeah. And 9 times out of 10, the driver is driving the simulated car the same way that they drive their actual race car. So when you start to then overlay the data from the real world and the simulation sessions that they do, you see certain trends and certain techniques coming through. So the, you know, the techniques in terms of how to drive a race car quickly around a track that our customers are taught in the simulator, they apply 100% to the, you know, to when you actually go.
Freezing up a little bit. Oh, are you still there? I think we made it possible.
That's been playing up worldwide.
I think Adam's roboting a bit.
I think it's freezing up a little bit. It might come back in. That was hopefully Adam will come back to us in a wee second. He might just have to refresh his page.
If, he might have to refresh the screen there. But yeah, that was interesting stuff. And yeah, our trip down to Leeds is absolutely fascinating to see the setup there. And seeing the factory next door to the simulator centre was brilliant, because it brings it home to you that this is real racing and it's a serious link to the actual race cars. Adam, obviously, he's just frozen up there with the internet.
I wonder if we can get it back. Carry on, John. Carry on.
What I was going to ask Adam, but he's not there at the moment, but we could ask him when he comes back online. If you have a Janita sort of package with Janita, do they include some simulator time with the package? Because I believe a lot of these programs are, you pay Janita, is it, what, £150,000 a year, was it? I don't know if they include sim time with that.
Oh, here we are. Yeah. Oh, there we are.
Hi, guys, sorry.
No, that's all right.
Sorry, I lost you. Modern technology.
We're all here in the countryside, internet, and suddenly all froze away. But Jonathan was going to ask you a question. You were saying, I'll let John.
Yeah, before it froze up there, the guys who do the Janita seasons, I mean, they pay Janita, what is it, about $150,000 a year to do a season? Does that include simulator time with yourselves, or do they have to add that additionally on to their budget?
Depends how each driver approaches it, to be honest. I mean, previously, no. We are, and just to be clear, that's not necessarily like $150,000 that they would pay direct to Janetta. That would be more in terms of the, I mean, obviously the car cost is in that anyway, but then you've got the sort of support team costs, consumables, your sort of tyre, fuel, race entries, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just a cost that they pay across to Janetta. But no, I mean, increasingly what we've done this season at this, because we have a close affiliation with Janetta, is that we've looked at doing season packages of simulator time as sort of part of their fees and their costs and things like that. But it varies from driver to driver, really. Not everyone wants it. Not everyone can access it, obviously, because geography is an issue as well. I should point out as well that, you know, whilst we are very closely linked and affiliated with Janetta, and a lot of our driver business comes from them, we're not a Janetta-only facility, so we work with drivers across a whole range of championships, you know, from sort of real kind of grassroots entry-level stuff right through, like I said before, to sort of drivers in British GT and touring cars, and even, you know, again, through the Janetta link, it with drivers in the LMP1 championship. So it's, you know, it's a facility for all drivers in all championships, whether they're novices or experienced drivers, and we tailor the sessions accordingly.
Yeah. And what has driven the increase in use of simulators? Is it technology and the affordability of simulation? And when did it start? Presumably the F1 guy started it due to testing limitations and cost, and presumably the technology has got slightly more affordable and filtered down.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, John, it started in F1 many moons ago. I think McLaren were the first guys to do it back about sort of 97, 98, I think, with the sort of Mika Häkkinen and David Coulthard era. And probably if you look now at the simulator they had, it would probably be less advanced than the one we have now. Yeah. So, and it's filtered down from there. And obviously, from an F1 point of view now, they tend to use it more from a car development point of view rather than a driver development perspective. But the technology has moved on from, you know, it's not just a gaming platform. It now is actually, you're modeling the physics of the car on the simulator to give that realistic feel. So it's time well spent and it's money well spent to do that. And I think as well, as the younger generation of drivers have come through, it's just it's just par for the course with them. It's what they've grown up with. Yeah. They look up at you, you know, your Max Verstappens and your Lando Norris's in F1, and that's all they're doing. You know, in lockdown, those boys, they're just on the sims and gaming the whole time. So it's interesting, actually, when you look at our customer split, you know, that it, without wanting to be too stereotypical about it, the older gentleman, you know, the gentleman driver that's been racing for 20, 30, maybe 40 years, if they're coming and using the simulator for the first time, they struggle with it. And, you know, they don't always get on with it. Mm-hmm. But the youngsters, they come along and invariably, I can't remember a case at all where one of the younger drivers hasn't just hopped in and got to grips with it straight away. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of become ingrained in their culture. And I think it's now a part of the driver preparation, you know, so the fitness, the nutrition, simulated preparation, testing at track is all part of that package now that they all need to do.
Yeah. I mean, coming from the world of aviation or what's left of it now after this crisis that we've got,
yeah,
obviously a big part of being a pilot. If you want to go to, for instance, we go to Innsbruck Airport in Austria, it's quite a tricky airport down a valley. It probably costs the airline, I don't know, £50,000 to take an empty aircraft there to teach us how to do it. But the simulator, obviously the graphics are very accurate, and we can learn how to run the approaches, when to put the flaps out, when to put the landing gear down and get our profiles, and also do our emergency procedures. Perhaps not something which translates to racing, emergency procedures, but we can do that. And the cost to the company is, I think it's about £400 an hour to run an aircraft simulator compared to, I don't even know what the hourly cost of a 737 is, maybe £10,000. I mean, it's as well as all the fuel and emissions and landing fees and charges that go with it. So it's something that we're very familiar with in aviation. And I'm surprised it's taken as long in a way to get through to motorsport, because simulators have been part of aviation since the 70s, really, even before then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I ask, just a quick question, because we've got lots of viewers watching and they've asked some questions. And we've got some fans for you, Adam. We've got a lady called Tracy Walker, who said,
Tracy,
yes,
play poker with Tracy.
Well, she says that you are her hero.
I'll have to pay her later for that.
But she comes and says, what's the youngest age that someone can come and use the simulator?
It's a good question, that, and it's one that we get asked quite a lot, actually. The youngest person we have had in the sim is a young lad of 10 years old, who's a young carter, has got aspirations to be racing professionally when he's a bit older, and obviously starting out in Ginettas. Young lad called Ty Cuthbert, who's sort of on the journey through the karting world. Really, it's down to whether they can reach the pedals. You know, if they can reach the pedals and see over the wheel, that's the main deciding factor. You know, and these karting kids, they will come in and get in the car and be quick in it straight away. So that's not really the issue. It's the fact, you know, can they reach the pedals? And, you know, we get, you know, the most, you know, a lot of racing drivers are pretty slight and small, like jockeys, some of them. So we have to use booster seats for some of the grown-up racing drivers, let alone the kids.
Brilliant.
A booster seat, that's just a brilliant image of it.
I won't mention any names at this point.
Felipe Massa's not exactly a tall bloke, is he?
Yeah. No, exactly.
This would be an interesting question for Andrew, because obviously Jonathan and I, we've had goes on these kind of simulators now a couple of times, things like that, and kind of getting used to them in a little bit. But for somebody like Andrew, for example, let's use you as an example, Andrew. If you were to start afresh and come into...
Is that where you're going here? Yeah.
Well, because you've not done it before, I thought to go to somewhere like Adam's, to go to SimTrack, and if you never raced before, how do you think, you know, in terms of from starting from scratch and then at the end of the day, if you did like a full day's course, do you think you could get somebody like Andrew, you know, doing pretty well by the end of the first day?
Before you answer that, Adam, I'd just like to say we've been watching the virtual F1.
Oh, we can't hear you, Andrew. I can't hear you.
Can't hear me?
We can hear you.
I got you.
I could. Okay, see.
Can you hear me now?
Testing. Can you hear me now?
Yep, you're watching the virtual F1.
Yeah, it's good.
Jonathan, it's his fault. He's upside down and he's deaf. Sorry, Jonathan. was that, yeah, but we're watching that, and of course you get Johnny Herbert and Jenson Button get into their sims. And especially Johnny Herbert is highly entertaining, but usually at the back. Now, he's had a long and very successful career as a racing driver, and he got into sim, and, you know, okay, he was all right in the world of, you know, compared to me. So I would personally expect me not to be very good at all to start with. You know, that's if that's anything to go by, looking at experienced racing drivers getting into that kind of thing, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult one. It's very difficult to tell who's going to be good in the simulator and who's not. And like I said before, it's not for everyone. You know, there are issues sometimes around sort of feelings of motion sickness. And for older drivers who've grown up learning their craft through real life racing and real life testing, it can be harder.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Schumacher, between what you feel and what you see.
Yeah, you know, Michael Schumacher is probably the most famous case of someone that couldn't get on with the simulator at all. You know, he really struggled, you know, because it sort of probably when he started his career, they weren't really being used. And then by the end of his career, when he was driving for Mercedes, it was a big part of what the teams did. And he really couldn't get on with it. And, you know, there's clearly no questioning his abilities when it comes to driving on the track.
Yeah.
So it's just like with any, you know, driving any car or any race car, I think there's a period of time where you have to get familiar with it, and it does take time, and it doesn't initially feel natural. But what we tend to find is if drivers haven't used simulators before, they come to us for an initial session, maybe don't get the most out of it, but then when they come back for their next session, it clicks in place and they're a lot more comfortable with it. You know, they know the environment, they know what the sensations and the feeling of it are. But, you know, it certainly isn't a given that just because you're a quick driver in real life, that you'll be quick in the simulator. You know, it doesn't necessarily correlate in that way. If I take the example of the youngsters, then, you know, generally they will be quick in both. If I look at people like, you know, James Kellett, that is our in-house driver coach for SimTrack. Charlie Robertson, who does some of our coaching, he's the Ginetta LMP1 driver. They're both about 21, 22, I think. Been driving all their life. Both unbelievably quick drivers. You know, two of the quickest, probably the quickest guys I've ever come across. And they jump in the sim, and they're every bit as quick in the sim as they are in real life, which is frustrating and more than a little bit annoying sometimes.
it's a parallel skill with those.
Yeah, and part of it is the fact that they've obviously used simulators a lot as they were growing up. You know, James works with me at SimTrack, so he lives and breathes it. He's in the car all the time. When he's not in the simulator, he's on a car at a racetrack coaching people or racing himself. So, you know, if he could be in a car 24/7, he would be. And so it's all just second nature to him. And, you know, that's why it's, you know, you use the example of Johnny Herbert. He probably hasn't done a huge amount of simulator time. He would have retired from F1 before simulators were the norm. So
he retired from Stewart, didn't he? Stewart Grand Prix. So,
Can I quickly say, it was interesting because one of the things we saw, and I think what maybe marks people like Jenson Button and Johnny Herbert out, is that when they were racing, they were sticking to the track limits.
Yes.
They weren't cutting corners. But all the other guest drivers and some of them, they were basically straight lining half the corners and going way over the lines.
We noticed that the pro sim drivers, they were also sticking to the track. There was this kind of grey area between old-fashioned real racing drivers and the young, you know, the Landos and the Clerk wasn't too bad, but that some of the others were a bit.
I think they make those series that they let them get away with things that there's no damage on the cars. I think for people of our age who are big Formula One fans and proper kind of and racing fans, I think that's what's lacking, is because from what you do.
Yeah.
You are doing it absolutely to the T. So you're going to have track limits. You're going to have, you know, if you don't have traction control on and you accelerate too fast out of a bend, you're going to spin round. You're going to, all these things that are real to life. And I think that's what we miss, because when we've been doing our commentary so far, We want real races that are actually hard and decent and realistic. It's not for, and you know, I think the arcade appeal, if you make it too easy or if you allow them to cut corners, their times are unrealistic. You know, that it takes away from it. And I think what you do is really good. And going back to my point with Andrew, see, I reckon because of your instructors like James Kellett, you would probably find that you might maybe struggle a little bit at the start, but James is so good at telling you how to brake and how to accelerate. I mean, I could not believe how hard it was to brake with that pedal on those cars. It's solid. And so it's so real. And then, you know, so you probably find you'll knock off 2 or 3 seconds by the end of the day or even more once you get used to it. If you've got that kind of one-to-one tuition, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah, and I think undoubtedly, if you've never been on track before and you were going to be going and doing a day at, you know, Blyton Park or Donington or wherever, if you spent a day in the simulator learning the track, learning sort of key driving techniques, without a shadow of a doubt, when you turn up at Donington Park or Blyton the next day, will be quicker.
Roboting again.
Oh, it's freezing a little bit. I wonder whether there's other things happening. Oh, Jonathan's gone. Now the two have gone. From 4 to 2, well, stick with us because I'm sure they'll be right back.
Just two of us. I just want to make a point of answering something Tracy Walker's put down. She said she saw Sir Chris Hoy in a Caterham and think it would benefit from some sim training. Hoy is actually racing in GT races now. He's now a professional. They had him on, didn't they, with the sim, the virtual Grand Prix at the beginning, didn't they? When they had him on, they were saying, oh, the cyclist. Well, you know, he's not a cyclist anymore. He was a cyclist. You know, he's a cyclist in the same way Jackie Stewart's a champion clay pigeon shooter. Chris Hoy is now racing in GT, and he's very good. So I would imagine, because he's racing for quite a good team, that he's doing sim training anyway right now.
It might be, Adam, perhaps if you have other browsers that are running in the background if they're non-essential, if you can turn anything else off and just have the browser for this screen, that might just help. Sometimes it can take away bandwidth if you have other browsers on at the same time.
Or it could be the superstars are all doing helpful videos.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? All the celebrities doing that.
Pictures of flowers and showing us how much they love us on his video.
How hard life is living in a £12 million mansion.
Yes, exactly. My favourite ones are the ones that don't do any of that and just do something. Steve Martin just did a fantastic bit of banjo work and then said, bye. To make him feel like he cared. He just thought, this is, I'm going to entertain you now. And off he went. Great.
That was that. Oh, brilliant. Going to one of our viewers, Tracy Walker, said that she saw Chris Hoy in his Caterham and think he'd benefit from coming for some sim training as well. So I think everybody would, you know, and I think it's something that you can't ignore. It's now part of motorsport, and hopefully, as things get back to normal, you'll start to see it take off. Because we all felt, especially in January, February time, when we saw your winter challenges and all this, we were quite excited, and I was so annoyed that, let's just say, the bean counters in my family refused to let me come back down to Leeds because I was going to have another go. I was going to have another go to try and beat Jonathan.
Don't talk about anything like that.
You do know one of those bean counters is quite capable of watching this.
Well, we'll see.
And I'm not sure you like the makeup to hide the bruising.
But you're really kind of getting things going, and hopefully that will resume as things start to move forward. And they were great challenges and good tracks, and you know, I think that's a great way of encouraging people to give it a shot and come in and have a go.
Yeah, that really was just a bit of fun over the winter. Obviously, the you know, as you guys will know, the race season is pretty much sort of March to October. Once that stops, once you get to, I mean, it might be a bit different this year, but once you get to October, everyone sort of, you know, goes into hibernation, really. All the drivers are sort of, you know, just literally counting the cost of how much they've spent and just planning for the next year. So the driver market drops off quite a lot at that time. So we did those things over the winter just to kind of keep things ticking over, get a few new faces in. Just picking up on a couple of your earlier points, well, Chris Hoy actually has been to our place. He was our VIP opening guest, so he has been down and is very good driver in his own right now. So must have been on an off day when Tracy saw him in the cage room.
I did actually point out that he's races professionally for GT racing now. Probably, we were just saying that in the I think it was the very first virtual Grand Prix, they had him as a guest, didn't they?
He was in that one, wasn't he? Yeah.
And they just listed him as a cyclist, and it's like, yeah, he was a cyclist. He's not anymore.
No, he's a very good driver now in his own right, and you can
fantastic documentary of showing him getting into the team and starting, and he was good
and his work ethos that was what really struck me. I mean, he came to our he came as our VIP guest on our opening day, basically. So he was really just to come and have a bit of a try of the sim and a bit of a play. But you know, we couldn't get him off the damn thing. He was just constant thirst for wanting to go quicker. You know, he was all over the data, wanting to understand where he was losing time. And you know, he'd just come for a bit of a trial run. He was sort of dripping with sweat when he came out of it. And you realise why the guy is been so successful in his main discipline, and he's translating those skills across to racing. Something. I was just going to say, Hugh, about the gaming side of things. You know, sort of the esports that's obviously a big thing at the moment. This is proving a bit of a dilemma for us, really, because we're we very much positioned ourselves from day one as driver training and not gaming. You know, there's plenty of sim centres you can go to where it's all about 10 rigs lined up next to each other, and it's sort of, you know, a bit like going on a karting trip. And whilst there's some similarities with the platforms that we use and some of the software that we use, the way that we use that software and the sort of bespoke nature of what we do in terms of building the car models makes us a very different proposition to gaming. Yeah. You know, none of the stuff that we do in the sim is, you know, there's never any other cars on the track. No, it's literally, no. It's a practice session. It's you in the car on the track, and it's comparing your data against the coach's data. Occasionally we'll do a thing where there's sort of a ghost car. You know, James might set a reference lap and have the ghost car on there. But we're not doing it as a gaming thing. But this whole thing with the lockdown and coronavirus and everything has really brought esports to the fore, hasn't it? And it's you know, we're having constant discussions around what the right thing to do it. You know, is it something we need to embrace as a business? Clearly, from a drivers, while they're sat there at home not doing anything, they're looking for something to fill their time. So they're getting all over the various different racing leagues that are appearing online. You know, I still don't believe it's the right business model for us, but I think as a stopgap to sort of tide us over this lockdown period, there's some interesting things that we could do. And we're actually having some discussions internally with Janetta and also Want to Race, who are previously Book a Track based down at Donington, having some discussions with those guys about how we could actually set up some kind of potential competition to take a driver from the sim world to the racing world, which is, I think, puts a bit more of an interesting angle on it then, rather than let's play in an online racing league and, you know, see how many crashes we can have.
So
you could take your software, which you obviously very advanced and representative of a real car, and adapt that. You wouldn't even need to use the setup you've got. You could sort of adapt it to a slightly less serious purpose, couldn't you?
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I mean, we could
people that want to use that kind of thing. Like a separate stream, you know.
Yeah, we could host events and, you know, race series from our server at SimTrack that people could then use their own simulators to compete on.
I know two people that will be very interested.
Yeah. The dilemma for me on that, though, is part of our USP is our hardware and our technology and the realism of the sim.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, we would far rather have people coming to the sim center.
You don't want to dilute the brand image in a sense that you don't.
Not really, but you know, never say never. And we're in very strange times, and everyone's having to sort of pivot their business and look for different angles. And without a shadow of a doubt, esports has taken the motorsport world by storm, hasn't it? So it may be.
That's despite, frankly, in my opinion, the Formula One people dropping the ball. If you look what they've done, it's taken them months, weeks and weeks and weeks to get any kind of
anything close to being professional enough.
Professional. In fact,
unlike IndyCar, IndyCar in America has done it far better.
Formula E, which just started an eight week championship with proper rules and damage and all this kind of stuff, and with proper the proper commentators, Dario Franchi and Jack Nicholls. Hugh and I, when we were sort of fake commentating on the first one, one of the reasons why we were doing it is because we were so frustrated by the idiots they had sat there. Jack Nicholls, who's a great commentator, and I listened to on 5 Live, was trying to do a professional job, and then there was three students next to him, just take a pick out of him, and you're like, you've suddenly got hundreds of thousands of people watching you, and this is how you step up to the plate?
The F1 guys had a massive opportunity there, didn't they, to really put on something quite special. I mean, I watched that first, was it Bahrain, the first one they did, that Chris Hoy took part in, and I've not watched one since, to be honest with you, because I found it not particularly interesting or entertaining. So it's funny, you know, I have to say, for me, it doesn't float my boat, in all honesty, which might sound like a strange thing for the MD of a simulator center to say, but it's I mean, part of that is because I don't have a sim at home. I've got all on sort of homeschooling two little people and everything else, but it's
it doesn't float
my boat, and I'm far more interested in how we can work with drivers, you know, in the from the real racing scene, and take, you know, improve their skill sets to take onto the track.
It has got better, especially now. Charles Leclerc and Lando, George Russell.
They've gone seriously
in a fun way, but they are actually applying themselves to do a good job. There are things they could really do to make it a bit better, but it's taken four races to get there. So
I can see in a way, Adam, your point, you know, your point of view is very strong, because what your side of the business is the absolute professional side. And when I looked at the cutout of your simulator, even in the room, and in the one you had outside as well, I mean, there's so much technology that goes into that. It's huge. Yeah. It's incredible, as it was a real car as well, wasn't it? The one that we were using. And it's kind of amazing. And if people haven't seen that, it's actually just worth having a look when you're there, because to see all the wires and computer parts and everything that goes in, and even though it's not a kind of motion simulator, it looks like one because of all the bits you know, that kind of make it all work. And I can see that you're coming from that side of it. It's almost like you're like Ron Dennis at McLaren. You know, you want to do it seriously, you want to do the whole thing the way it should be, and that's really important, because if people like you were in charge of doing the simulators like they are in F1, you know, it'd be a very different theme to it. Because you want it to be real.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
No, but that's true. And I think you have to be real to that, because, you know, that's what you're doing. You know, if you can develop, you know, you've got James Kellett there, who's doing very, very well. You know, you've got top class instructors. And I think for to get access to them alone for the money that you charge is a bargain. I mean, I was very excited. I mean, I'm trying to save up so I can spend a bit more money on doing these kind of proper simulation events. Eventually, I can go to the track and have a go and not come last, you know. So I want to try and, you know, be ready and be prepared. And I think anyone watching this, if they're serious about ever having a go at motor racing for real, they need to come to people like yourself at SimTrack, and they will get the best experience they'll ever have. You know, I genuinely think that if you can get a few days here, my goodness, what you could learn. I thought from 15 minutes, I learned a huge amount. So I can't emphasize enough, I think, just how good your service is. And I think the way it's going, I think you're going to have a big influence on racing in the UK from what you're doing.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. I think one thing that perhaps is testament to that is it's really interesting earlier this week when the TOCA announced their revised calendar, you know, kicking off in August, isn't it? And then it's a crazy calendar. I don't know how they're going to deliver it because they've got four back-to-back races in August alone. But wow. I think it was on Tuesday or Wednesday that calendar was announced. And I must have had five or six of our sim customers ringing me up or messaging me saying, can you book me in? I want every Monday before each of those races. You know, I want a 3-hour session. I want, you know, one guy asked for a 6-hour block. You know, wow. It's kind of that to me is proof that, you know, they're missing the fact they can't get on track in real life. And suddenly that revised race season is going to be upon them. And they're not going to have been out in the car anywhere near as much as they want to be.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, I've got to get in the sim. I've got to get my eye in, get, you know, and these are guys who, these are guys who I know from social media have got their own simulator setups at home. Mm. You know, they've been doing the various online gaming bits and pieces, but you know, that was something of a relief to me, I'll be honest, because, you know, sort of looking around social media, seeing all of our customers engaging in the online sim racing with their own rigs at home, you think, well, is that potentially going to take them away from using our facility? But the fact that some of those guys straight away are like, I need to come back and do the thing, do it properly, you know, because what you don't have, you know, at home, you don't have, you know, you don't have the quality of the screen. You don't have the quality of the car model. You don't have, you know, a James Kellett or a Charlie Robertson sat alongside you. You don't have the data side of things. So, you know, it's a very different beast, really, if you're using a home sim compared to a professional sim.
Yeah.
How does your setup compare with the only thing that, you know, the kind of thing I knew anything about at all, a little bit about, was the F1 stuff? You know, like, I've seen the documentaries where Red Bull have taken you around their sim and this kind of stuff and won't tell you anything about it. But what would be the similarities? What would be the differences? Obviously, so from what you've just said, it's obvious that your setup is far superior to any home setup and anything that you could get in a home setup. But how would it compare with the people that have got tens of millions to spend on, you know, like the Red Bulls, the McLarens, the Mercedes, the Williamses, and this kind of stuff?
Have you still got me?
Yeah.
So the fundamental kind of setup and concept is actually very similar. You know, the sort of, obviously, the extent of the technology being used by the F1 teams, where they literally are spending millions of pounds, we are never going to compete with that. But like I said earlier on, the primary use of the F1 simulators is for car development. You know, it's for testing a new aerodynamic part that they want to bring to the car, or, you know, sort of shaking it down before it even hits the track. You know, with the best one in the world, the F1 drivers don't need simulator time. You know, they're sort of up to speed. So they're very much modeling the car to react to sort of aerodynamic or mechanical changes they're making to it. But obviously they're full motion rigs, and they're motion rigs done properly. And you really do need to spend sort of millions of pounds for a proper motion rig simulator. But in terms of, you know, if you've ever seen the kind of behind the scenes videos they've done where they've gone into Mercedes, I think they did one at Renault last year on Sky Sports F1. You know, the setup is the same. You know, they've got the simulator room with a big screen. They've got a control room. And, you know, whereas we've got one desk of computers, they've probably got about 10. But, you know, it's fundamentally the same sort of setup. It's what we call driver in the loop in terms of the way that the driver is an integral part of the simulator and the simulator setup and the feedback coming from the driver to the engineer in the simulator room. You know, so all that is much the same. And the way that you're getting real time data as you're doing your session that's being fed back to the instructor or the engineer in the control room, you know, that is all very, very similar technology. So, you know, there's clearly very different price points, and these guys are spending millions and millions of pounds on a simulator that is purely for their own use. Yeah. You know, the simulators that are in the sort of commercial use sector, like what we're doing, like what sort of iZone and Base Performance are doing, you know, they're simulators that are that are worth more, sort of like between say 150 and 200,000 pounds for the sim kit, which is clearly light years away from the millions of pounds that Mercedes F1 are spending. But equally, it's light years away from, you know, little Joe playing on his PlayStation in his bedroom. So
yeah, but it was very impressive. I mean, I have to say, when Jonathan and I were down there, it was amazing seeing just the braking, and you have all your screens, and James was showing us where he braked, and then we saw where we braked, and it was like everything for us was red. how bad it was. You know, you were expecting a sound of concrete wall at the end of the corner, you know, but no, it was really good, because that shows you how near you can get. And it's even though it might not be the millions of pounds, it's incredibly good for what you need, and it seems to work well.
How easy is it to adapt the simulator you've got to, say, different series of racing? If someone was in the Clio Cup, or maybe a historic racer, or even single seaters, can you adapt your kit for that, or are you very much GT?
It's a good question, that, John. I mean, in an ideal world, we would have a replica cockpit for every type of type of race car that there is, but there's obviously sort of cost and space implications with that. There's two parts to it, really. Obviously, you've got the software side of it. So the software is where we model the characteristics and the handling and the feel of the car. So in that respect, it doesn't matter. You know, if you could drive a Clio Cup car in an Aston Martin GT3 cockpit, but it would feel like a Clio Cup car. So that's the first thing, is to make sure that the software models are as close to the real thing as they physically can be. Then it's more just about kind of creating an environment that is something close to what the majority of our users would have or experience. So, you know, we've got a GT car cockpit, as I say, with the paddle shifts, which, you know, very much covers off then all your kind of top end GT cars. It doesn't really matter whether it's GT3, GT4, touring car. You know, they're all that's very sort of applicable to that market. And then the other cockpit we've got is the you know, the G40, which, you know, with a little bit of imagination, kind of replicates the majority of you know, your sort of more entry level race cars, really. So in an ideal world, we would have a single seater cockpit as well. Mm-hmm. Potentially a prototype cockpit because of the affiliation with the Ginetta LMP1 program. Mm-hmm. But we took a conscious decision with the business actually to go down a tin top and GT route, because that's where the volume is. You know, the single seater market in terms of the sort of ladder in the UK is actually very small. And a lot of the single seater teams already have their own simulators in, you know, in their premises. So, we took the decision that we would focus on that sort of tin top and sports car market, which is where the volume is, you know, by a long way.
And do you check, when we were there, when Hugh and I were there, you had the Aston Martin sort of front end that we were sitting in to drive. Do you swap that out for the G40? Do you actually move, take it in and out? And it just
exactly that, yeah. So it's
into the software and the screens quite easily.
Yeah. So as far as I know, and if anyone's watching who disputes this, then forgive me, but as far as I know, we're the only simulator center in the country who are interchanging cockpits in that way. So if you look at two of our biggest competitors, they actually have two separate simulator rooms. They have a single seater cockpit room and a GT cockpit room. We've, because of space limitations and budget and everything else, we're working with one main sim room, but we swap the cockpits over. So we've developed a system which makes it very easy to sort of unplug one, wheel it out, wheel the other one back in, and plug it in, and away we go. And the, you know, the software talks to both of them in the right way to make them work. So in theory, you know, like I say, we could have 3, 4, 5 different simulator cockpits sat there that we could wheel in and out. Whether that would actually be beneficial and sort of cost effective to do, I don't know, but it could be done in theory.
Yeah. Just going back to, you said you could get a ghost car where James was set a time. Is the AI available to actually teach people how to race craft, sort of how to overtake into corners, or is that just not quite there yet?
So one of the things that we're looking at doing on that front is actually to invest in what we're calling a baby sim. So actually get one of these sim rigs, like, you know, like people would have at home, mm-hmm. whereby you can then practice racecraft with the instructor. Yeah. So if one of you guys was in as a customer, then, you know, James or myself or whoever could jump on the other sim and be on the same track as you in the same car and practicing racecraft. And certainly for the juniors, that would be, you know, that would be very useful. We could kind of practice qualifying runs, could sort of practice slipstreaming and defending, lots of different racing techniques to work with them on.
Because that's a much harder thing to sort of train, I suppose. To a certain extent, that's an asset that a driver has. Whereas, you know, learning a track, it's a big step on from learning a track, getting fast, learning your braking points, your gear change points, your turning points, to actually teaching how to set up a pass. You're almost reading the other driver's mind. It's very hard to.
It is very difficult. I think, you know, where you see that, you know, really played out is when, you know, some of these kids that James and Charlie and co coach on a daily basis can be as rapid as you like on, you know, on a test day, and can get very close to their times even. But then it comes to a race situation and they haven't perhaps got the skill set or the experience, and it all sort of unravels very quickly. So if we can introduce ways on the simulator that we can practice that racecraft, mm-hmm. then I think it is a very very beneficial thing. And to be fair, pre-COVID-19, we were very much on the cusp of installing this second baby sim that would, you know, it would kind of sit. I'm not sure exactly where in the room it would sit, but, you know, it doesn't need to be massive, but it's just somewhere that the coach or another person can sit and be driving the car and practicing racing techniques with the customer.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a great feature, actually, wouldn't it? And just add an extra, really good, valuable kind of link to people to racecraft. Because it's one thing doing well on a time trial. You know, we can do that on a time trial. You can work all day on that. But then racecraft is absolutely important, because, you know, otherwise you wonder why they keep crashing. Yeah. Because they're going into the same people. They're just getting involved in the same situations. While your guy can help to teach you how to avoid that. So how do you think, and we've been going on for a good 50 minutes, and I really appreciate your time tonight.
Not doing anything else, Hugh, so.
we'll take you on that one, or another 3 hours in. But how do you see it kind of developing this year? Because do you have plans to launch anything like any other new offers or kind of other challenges that might be coming once things kind of get back to normal or as they open up a bit?
It's really tricky. I mean, like I said right at the start, we were building up such a head of steam with this business in sort of through February and March, and, you know, getting people signed up to season packages for their, you know, to take them through their race season, et cetera, and lots of different ideas of things we're going to do. And then suddenly, you know, as with many, many other businesses, it's just been sort of cut off at the knees and mothballed. So trying to plan in terms of what we're going to do is a little bit difficult, because, you know, our income has just dried up in that respect. That said, what this period of time is giving us, and is giving a lot of business owners, I suppose, is that chance for, you know, that thinking time and that sort of strategizing time, which, you know, I certainly wasn't getting prior to this. So, you know, there's a few things in the pipeline. I think what we've got to do and do very well is that if and when the race season does restart, and, you know, let's keep our fingers crossed for everyone involved that it does restart, then we need to be ready to hit the ground running and to be able to cope with the inevitable demand that we're going to have for people wanting to come and use our facility. So that's sort of plan A. And then plan B really, I think, is then just sort of to keep ramping up the level of service. You know, we're constantly investing in new technology. We've recently partnered with Race Logic, who anyone in the racing world will know them. They provide the in-car lap timers for a lot of club level and pro level race cars. They've now got a sim specific product. So we've now got that in our simulators, which just makes the data analysis side even better. So it's just little things like that, really. And then we'll, you know, as I alluded to before, we're in conversations with Janetta themselves and with the guys that want to race about how we could potentially use this huge growth in esports and simulator use at home, and try and, you know, see if we can find a diamond in the rough. You know, there's plenty of quick sim racers out there. Let's see if we can hone that and sort of get them on a proper sim and see if that can take them into the real life race world. That, you know, that would be quite an interesting challenge and proposition for us to look at, I think.
And something
that other sim companies actually would be less able to do because they don't have a direct affiliation with a manufacturer or a racing series. So we're in a prime position to be able to do that, to be fair.
Yeah. I mean, I know you'd been to like the Autosport show early in the year and I think you've been to Silverstone as well, wasn't it? You went to Silverstone for a kind of motorsport show.
Motorsport Days Live, yeah.
And I happened to watch one of the big kind of simulator shows that was in at the Nürburgring in Germany, and I think it was in October last year, October, November, they're thereabouts. And it looked amazing, actually, because they've got a huge exhibition hall where they put on events and they had lots of different companies from all over the world who turned up there. Would that be something you think you might eventually go to if you thought it would be a way ahead?
Yeah, potentially. They're interesting, these trade shows. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily just specific to the motorsport industry. I think every industry finds trade shows a slightly odd concept. Yeah. You know, they're one of those things you sort of have to be seen to be there. But when you look at the sort of nuts and bolts of it, do they actually generate any tangible business? It's difficult to say. So the big issue I have from what, and it goes back a little bit to that whole sort of gaming versus driver training thing again, the big issue I have with something like having a big presence at somewhere like Autosport is that every man Jack has got some kind of simulator on their stand there. Yeah. And for us, we couldn't transport what we've got to a remote location. So anything that we would take to exhibit at Autosport or another place would be a dumbed down version of what we're actually doing. And, I found actually more beneficial this year was for me and James and Rob to go around and just sort of network with people.
Yeah.
Death by internet.
It's freezing a little bit there.
It's a roboting again, Adam, if you can hear us.
But for all our viewers, you're watching the car race driver show with me, Hugh Hattrick, with Andrew Marr, Jonathan Sutherland, and of course our very special guest, Adam Croft from simtrack.co.uk, which unfortunately just the screen has frozen. Oh, here it comes. I'll remove one. And I'll hopefully here you are. He's back again. Here we go. Oh.
I think what Adam needs to do while he's not listening is he needs a government contract. He needs to do police speed awareness courses to tell people that they can actually overtake. That's what they should do. Yeah. And how to use roundabout too. Oh,
class one training on a sim. That would be amazing.
We're back.
Sorry about one of my first jobs tomorrow needs me to get onto Sky broadband and get this sorted out. So
that's the same. Seems to be working okay.
Jonathan had a good idea there for you.
I think Adam, when you weren't listening, it'd be sacrilege to your business. But what you need is a government contract for teaching people how to drive. So I reckon all awareness courses need to go to SimTrack and be £250 an hour, whatever it is, to get trained to tell them how to blimmin' drive.
Class one training here. Yeah. Safety
about safety. Yeah, that's right. You could get a roundabout and show them how to use it. That could be
something in that.
Or get going.
Yeah.
That's it. Be in the right gear when you come out up a hill and to overtake.
This could spiral down very quickly.
We are diluting Adam's brand image all the time here.
The people.
So it's all right. Other additional revenue sources always worth looking at.
Fantastic. People that go to Adam's business.
Just getting somebody to pay the money, I suppose, isn't it? Getting a bum on a seat, paying an hourly charge, I guess.
Yeah.
But the gaming side of it, I mean, there are a lot of people that take it tremendously seriously. I mean, they're not actually just messing around. Some of these guys take it really seriously. And actually, I think a serious gamer, there's money in it. And if they could sit with James in that car, they could get a lot better very quickly.
Oh, yeah. And, don't get me wrong, guys. I'm not taking anything away from that from that world. You know, I think there's, you know, it is a different world, and but it's a discipline in its own right now. And you know, you look at, again, going back to some of the F1 teams, they are recruiting sim drivers as some of their, you know, I think Mercedes have got a guy that's a sort of world champion sim racer who's now one of their kind of simulated test drivers. So, and you know, Nissan did it with their, I forget what it's called now, GT Academy or something a few years ago with Jan Mardenborough. That basically took a gamer into the racing world. And yeah, there's you know, there's some quick lads out there. And I think it's you know, it's interesting when you can always tell the gamers when they come to our sim center, you know, if they're sort of gamers looking to get into racing, you can spot them a mile off in terms of the way they drive on the sim, and perhaps are taking a few more liberties than you would do in real life, say. But you know, some of them do definitely have that certain extra bit that could translate into being successful on track without a shadow of a doubt. So
I always remember on the early kind of F1 games, some of the guys who were doing the best times, when you watch their videos of how they did it, you know, they were changing down ridiculously early and the wheels were locking, but they were somehow, by doing that, able to get enough grip or, you know, go over a curb. And you couldn't do that in real life. Your car would explode, you know. So
I think you might cause a bit of engine damage there if you change down to seconds at sort of 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the computer allowed them to get away with that.
Exactly.
In real life, you would never be allowed to do it. And that's why SimTrack is so good, because it's proper professional racing and you know, driving like you're supposed to, but it's also within the standards, because there's obviously racing etiquette and you know, if someone's doing the racing license, like the two of you have done already, you know, you have to be good. You know, you have to build sure that you don't crash on your first few races. You've got to build up points and have a very good safety record, isn't it, to maintain your racing license. And I think maybe that's not quite covered yet in the kind of online racing kind of simulators at the moment. It's still it's really more of a game effect, and no one really suffers from a bad race kind of thing. And but when they're going to people like yourself, they're getting the true story.
And we, you know, we the way we run our sessions is, you know, we're not playing at this, we're not messing about. Yeah. You know, we haven't really touched on it, but it's not particularly relevant for this. We do a corporate angle as well, so where you have, you know, we run corporate days for businesses, so that's more, you know, more a fun element. But when we're doing the one-to-one coaching and driver training with the drivers, you know, we want them to be in the same mindset they are when they're in the race car and when they're going out and doing a test session or a qualifying session. And, you know, James sometimes will get quite sort of quite vocal with them sometimes to make sure they're in the right mindset and not just sort of prattling about, because whilst it's, you know, it's cost effective compared to going on track in real life, it's still an expensive luxury to come and do a session. You know, if you're going to spend sort of £400 or £500 to come and work with us for half a day, then you want to get the most out of it. And for that reason, you know, we're not going to tolerate people cutting corners or doing, you know, track limits that would be penalized in real life. We want to reflect that in the you know, in the sim sessions as well. And it's, you know, sometimes you do, especially with the youngsters, sometimes you get that, you know, they maybe come straight from school, they're not quite in the mindset, and they'll get in and they'll be sort of playing at it a bit, and it's like, no, let's, you know, have a time out, come and get your head together and do the job properly, like we know you can do. So it's important to treat it like the real thing, and then I think people respect it more, and I think they respect what you're doing more as well then.
I mean, that's fabulous. It's great to have all this information coming out, because I think for a lot of even, like, you know, us who are kind of keen gamers, because we've had a little bit of an experience of both sides of driving in real cars and so on, and then doing gaming, we want to be good. You know, we actually want to try and we're improving, and that we're doing it honestly, because that's what annoys me when you look at a time on some of the games and they're like, you know, where is that extra 2 seconds? And you think, and there's only so much, and then you find out that when you've watched them on their qualifying lap, they have basically cut a massive chicane and they're on the grass completely, and they're going up, and you think, well, hang on a minute, that kind of takes away from being accurate. Well, you know, maybe in the days when Ferrari could get away with that in Formula One and nobody turned a blind
eye. FIA lived the other way, exactly.
If it was the
controversial,
you know, they would be able to get, you know,
Ferrari Incorporated Association, yeah.
Well, you know, maybe they'll pay us not to mention them ever again.
These days, for some bizarre reason, people think it's the Mercedes Incorporated Association. Yeah. No, the guy that runs it used to run Ferrari. Come on. It's never going to be the Mercedes club.
But I think until they get that right, they're not going to get people like us. I mean, yes, we're on board. We like it because it's fun and we're involved in different ways. But I think for the genuine kind of, you know, motorsport fan who actually maybe might marshal or they go and attend races, mm-hmm. and the real genuine Formula One fan and motorsport fan, you know, they're not convinced. It's like you said, you watch the first virtual GP and you never watch it again. Because it's not really done properly. I mean, if it even had Martin Brundle and David Croft doing the commentary, we may have taken it a bit more seriously. But, it still needs to be, you know, people want to see that it is real, or as real as and as close to real racing as possible. I think until it gets to that level, it's always going to struggle.
I think here the interesting thing will be is to see when we all resume some kind of normality, whenever that is, mm-hmm. And you know, we can go back to racing in the real world. You know, where will esports stand there? You know, I think it's definitely filling a gap at the moment. And it's giving something for people to talk about, and creating content for social media, et cetera, et cetera. But I think once the real racing starts back, it'd be interesting to see, you know, can esports then maintain this sort of this kind of peak that it's got now? I personally suspect not, but there's undoubtedly a place for it. There's definitely a place for it. Yeah. But, does it replace the cut and thrust of real racing and the enjoyment of tuning into a real F1 race or a touring car weekend? You know, I don't think it does yet, but it's certainly pretty interesting how it's literally exploded in the last few weeks, and it's everywhere. You know, the social media is just full of people, you know, racing in different sim racing leagues.
Suddenly, any kind of food tastes good.
Well, everyone's
some of it out because of that.
Yeah.
Well, I always remember my first ever taste of a simulator, like a proper one, that was a cutout of a car. It was probably the worst, not only the worst car, but the worst simulator you could ever drive. You never want to drive it. Whoever, it was at BSM, and I went to the NEC motor show way back in, like, I think it was 2002 or 2001, thereabouts. They had a cutout of a Vauxhall Corsa with the BSM top on it, and it was kind of half the car and with no doors, and it looked like it had been in a shunt from someone who just passed their test, and that was all that was left, you know. and they were charging about 20 quid an hour for people to kind of have a go. And the thing is, it was so bad, it was two old big TVs or three TVs that they put together, and someone made it work. But it was like watching a Pac-Man game, you know, from the kind of late 80s. It was that bad. And they'd given up. They'd actually given up charging because no one was using it. They're not paying 20 quid to get on that, let alone play it. Yeah. And so they decided that they would just make it free. So if anyone, any poor person that came along and said, you can have a go at that, they would let them have a shot. And the thing is, it was so bad that people were just taking the mick. And so they were driving around. It was this kind of alpine route that they had, and of course you were supposed to drive, like, you know, 60 miles an hour and slow down for the corners and not overtake, you know, in bad places. And all they were doing was, obviously, the lads were turning up and they were driving, like, you know, around the blind bends on the wrong side of the road. And they would, when there was one, of course, where you're ultimately going to hit something, and they came round in blind bend and there was a lorry, and of course they went straight head on into the lorry. And it just crashed the whole game as it went, game over.
And the beat. Well, it was a Vauxhall Corsa. What do you expect?
It was something, but
the alarm bell should have been ringing when you saw the cutout of the Vauxhall Corsa.
Did it have a big drain pipe sticking out the back and really low wheels? Made out of cardboard, you know.
The BSM managers were absolutely furious because they thought this was a great idea and this wonderful thing. And basically, it's almost like, you know, when Alfa Romeo took it up with Nissan to make the Alfa Arna, which is a Nissan.
You're setting it again.
Possible concept to have as a simulator. You take some terrible car and terrible graphics and put it together. And that was it. And thank the Lord, in 20 years, they've now put together some great cars with some great simulators, and it works, you know, so much better. But thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been fantastic, and
thank you.
As we finish the broadcast. And to all our viewers and listeners, and for your questions as well, it's been fantastic to have you all with us. Tracy did ask, I will say Tracy has asked many questions here. She did say, what is your favourite circuit? So perhaps in closing we can answer
that. My favourite race circuit?
Yes.
Without a shadow of a doubt, it is Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium. Without a shadow of a doubt, it's I've been lucky enough to race there 3 times, I think, now. It had been on the bucket list for as long as I can remember, and it didn't disappoint. I've never, apart from Silverstone, I don't think I've ever been to a racetrack where, when I've actually arrived and kind of looked at the circuit, you know, it's genuinely sort of given me goosebumps almost. And I remember the first, I actually went to watch the F1 there in, I think it was 2011, and the first time you kind of look, you know, because the outer paddock actually sort of gives a great view down through Eau Rouge. And, you know, the first time looking down there, I just thought, incredible. You know, it's just amazing. And when I then got to actually race there, it was just next level. So, yeah, that's the one for sure. I mean, there's still plenty of tracks on the bucket list, but for the ones I've been to, that's certainly up there.
Tracy has responded by saying, so it's not your local Spa car park then.
That's why I laughed. I wasn't laughing at you, Adam. All right. I just caught that comment and just couldn't help it.
If that was in Scotland, that would be a Scotland car park.
Yeah. Well, you know, needs must at these times. You know, any empty car park, you might have to just go and have a bit of play around in there.
If it was the old Hockenheim, it would be Lidl.
Yeah.
Well, you kind of think, but I used to shop in the Lidl and the Aldi near Hockenheim.
All right.
Well, long time ago. many years ago. Different life.
Maybe you'll be able to reopen earlier, because if you've got your site and there's not many people involved, you can if you all wore a forensic suit, you could all sit in the car and you'd be fine in it, or just clean it all afterwards. That would be your thing. But hopefully you can get started again very soon. And
that's the hope. Yeah, I think if we get some indication in the next, well, maybe next week, as to what businesses can and can't reopen, you know, I think we can limit what we do very much to one, you know, one person.
Oh, not again. Here we go.
It's almost there, and then
it's recording.
Well, I wonder if I should remove it, and you might retry.
Do it. Do it now. Do it.
And then there we come. There we are. That's it.
If in doubt, do it. It's Microsoft. You've got to reboot it somehow.
Sorry about that for all our viewers and watchers. We've just lost Adam just for a few seconds there. I'm sure he'll be right back in a few seconds. But thanks for being with us.
Tracy, because she made me laugh. Because it's his fault anyway.
But we'll be putting this out as well as a podcast, and it's fantastic that you've joined us tonight. It would be even better if you could subscribe to our channel. That would be fantastic. And share it out. Make sure you hit the notification so you never miss a show. That would be brilliant. It would be fantastic to do that. And Croft Circuit, I've written that down.
Croft, the racing commentator, I've crossed him out because I don't like
him. Oh, you don't want him. All right.
Oh,
here we are.
You're aware of that.
There we go. But there we are. Good to have you back.
Oh, yeah. Hell.
There we go.
Not that, Croft. I'm not showing that again.
I was going to say.
Andrew is not a fan of David Croft in commentary.
Yes, I've done that.
Ah, right, yeah.
And then, it wasn't that.
I like the Croft circuit.
Yeah,
and the only wise person here, as usual.
I really don't think
so. It's your name, so I do apologise.
Yeah, as I reappeared on the screen, it's the big thing.
Reading English, reading any language, really, you know.
No, it's great. That green label looks like your first racing sticker. Because you know when you start racing, you've got to show that it's your first time, isn't it? when you enter a series. What do they call it?
Your novice cross.
Yeah, your novice cross. That's what you have. So you can keep that. Keep that and then put it on as you when you get into a race car and have a go.
That's fantastic. Oh, wow.
Oh, you're going to regret coming on this show, Adam. But
good fun, good banter.
What I was going to say, Adam, is that I think you've got a good chance if we lobby Parliament or somebody really, really just keep showing them the commentary that's on the current virtual F1, the more they show that idiot with the glasses, the more they'll realise that what you do is an essential thing.
Yeah.
It'll be like torture, and they'll go, we've got to stop this and get Adam Croft and Tim Track, put them on telly, put them somewhere, do something with them. They're essential, get them back.
There's got to be a way we can be classified as an essential business, surely.
All these kids
stuck at home. You know, these kids stuck at home that have been, you know, in the middle of GCSEs or A levels or whatever doing. They're probably climbing the walls. They'd love to get out and come and use the sim. So we'd be providing an essential service in that respect.
I've watched the Ginetta Juniors, right? All these 13, 14-year-olds, and they are nuts, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, just watching that racing is possibly the most entertaining thing I've ever seen in my life, and that includes watching Morecambe and Wise and various other comedy shows that I think are really funny. Just for pure comedy entertainment, watching them go through, and it's when you were saying earlier about you get some youngsters that come from school and they're a bit silly.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's what's actually going on there, because maybe. Something disconnects and they just go, Banzai! And off they go.
Yeah. it's quite alarming when you see, you know, these
like stuck at home.
When you see these kids come to the sim, it's alarming. You know, some of them literally do look like they're about, you know, 8 years old. It's and then these are the guys that are going, you know, Banzai into Paddock Hill and taking out three other cars. You know, no fear. It's unbelievable.
I wish I could remember the name, which track it was. There's one where you get a long sort of sweeping straight, and then you get a very sharp right-hander, sharp left-hander, and then a sweeping right-hander onto the home straight. And that's the overtaking point, those three corners.
Yeah.
How you can get three Ginetta Juniors around every single one of them, and then they approach the last bit, the last bit, and it's really obvious you can't. And the curves are quite high there.
Yeah.
And the one on the inside, on the final corner, just straight lined it and became airborne, did a bit of an evil Knievel into the other two, and all three were out. And so
all three were out, yeah.
In the race, they were fighting for the win. At no point did any one of them think maybe third will be good compared to the last and a smashed up car. Fantastic. But if they hadn't done it, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as funny. It wouldn't have been.
So how old are these people racing cars? I mean, are they seriously 13 years old?
Yeah. Ginetta Juniors. You look them up. 14-year-olds.
I think it's 14 is the. I think it's 14 to 17 is the age. 14, the age yeah. range for the.
I remember
goodness
one of
the Ginettas, but you know, that's young, isn't it? You know, they're
it's pretty young. I guess they're not paying the bills when they take out.
No.
Yeah.
I think it's. No. Where you see the real difference is the kids that have karted all their life, they then come into cars and have got some real talent and real racecraft. But it's perhaps the ones that are coming into any form of racing for the first time at the age of 14. That's where it's sort of quite alarming. And you know, I take my hat off to James and co as instructors to sort of sit alongside some of these guys on a test day. It's you know, it's pretty brave of them, I think. So.
Well, I remember watching James race at Knock Hill. He had it on his YouTube channel. He was doing that incredible race at Knock Hill, where I think he ended up winning it. It was, like, I think, was he not passing Lando Norris? There's one where he passes Lando Norris, I think, to win. And the car looks so much on edge. I mean, it's just every corner, this Ginetta's fighting to go off the track, but he's keeping it on it. And then eventually he gets passed and he wins. And it's an amazing, you know, it's that kind of on edge racing, which is.
Oh, it's I mean, the cars are absolutely on a knife edge, and when you see, you know, you see people like James or, you know, Lando Norris, obviously, Charlie Robertson driving them. You know, they're literally on, you know, on the limit the whole time, and you know, it's pretty spectacular to watch, to be fair.
Yeah.
It is so entertaining. It's the only. There's a lot of good races that follow the BTCC, but for me personally, that's the one that sort of parallels what goes on in British Touring Cars itself.
It's the one, it draws the crowds, doesn't it, at those meetings? Everyone suddenly is like, oh, it's the Ginetta Juniors, let's go and watch
going on, you know?
Yeah.
The Formula, is it the Formula 4? They're all crazy, but they haven't got metal around them to smash into each other, so they don't barge each other like quite as much. They try, but it doesn't really work. But the Ginettas, both of them, really. I mean, the both Ginettas, I just think, are superb little.
The Super Cup, the G55 Super Cup is an incredible piece of kit. And obviously the racing in that is arguably a bit cleaner than the juniors, but equally the people racing them are that bit older. So they've earned their stripes in the juniors and then are graduating through. But the spectacle, I think, of those, you know, they're proper GT race cars, and I think they're sort of, the design of that car is like 10 or 12 years old now, but they still look fantastic on the track. So, it's good.
I was just trying to find them. I couldn't quite get it. I don't know, Jonathan, if you've got access to it, because there's a very famous photograph that we have that has you two in it, that has Jonathan and Adam Croft in it for all our viewers. I don't know if you can find it. It's that one when you were at Silverstone.
I know the one you mean, with a certain young 15-year-old lad.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes. Who has now made it to Formula One. And I was going to try and find it, but for the life of me, I mean, if you want to quickly chat for 2 seconds, I'm going to see if I can get it and see if I can share this. Unless you've got, have you got access to it there, John? Or are you struggling?
I've got it on my phone if you want me to get it.
Should we be alarmed that Hugh's got pictures of us from about 10 years ago, John?
I actually think he's in it too. I think he plonked himself on the podium with Kevin Magnussen.
Oh, yeah, you might be right, actually. Yeah.
I think I should have glory, Adam. I'll see if I can find it.
Because it's, it was very, I mean, that was such a good week to I'm sure you remember it well, actually. From what you learned and what you could get from it. And then, of course, the racing, because it was real at the end of the day. You had two big races to do. So hopefully we can get that photograph and we can show it. I could share the screen. I think it should be able to do that. But it's amazing when you get into those groups, isn't it? And you find you have a kind of quite a camaraderie with the 10 or 12 people that you're going to be racing with. And then in turn, you have a go. What was your kind of favourite memory from that event? For that week?
Oh, wow. Favourite memory? I think, without this sounding like too much of a cop-out answer, I think just the whole experience of doing that, it was just incredible, because I'd wanted to race all my life, and then at that point in time I was in a position to be able to go and have a go at it and go and get the license. And I don't think Silverstone run those courses anymore. It was 4 or 5 day intensive course, at the end of which you get your license and do your first two races.
That's Kevin Magnussen on our course.
Yeah.
And there's kind of people of kind of mine and Jonathan's age, and but then also if 15-year-old K-Mag turned up.
Oh,
and
there he is.
Look at that.
So it was just amazing. The amount that we learnt on that course was incredible. And I've stayed in touch with quite a few of the guys from that, interestingly, actually, do you remember Antonio Carosa?
Yes,
John.
Yeah.
So he now is one of the senior guys at Team BMR, Subaru BMR, and Soaring Cars. And we actually worked together last year. He came up to the sim with Senna Proctor. So it's kind of gone full circle, really. This course that we did, with all these wannabe race drivers 12 years ago, and we've all sort of went off in our different directions and did different things, and still in touch with you two guys, and fortunately I'm not still in touch with Mr. Magnussen, but
he comes right to mind the whole time.
But remember there were two groups in that one, and did it, I think was there not a Japanese driver from one, and he had a huge accident I'm sure it was on the other race, or just before. I think you guys had your race.
That would be Antonio, wasn't it?
That's Antonio. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. And the other guy was quite a was not a Formula Ford guy. The guy on Antonio's left.
Yeah.
I think he was quite talented. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a couple of Magnussen that was there with a couple of pals, wasn't he? There was a couple of Danish guys and
yeah. It was just picking the box for him, wasn't it? It really was. It was just, let's just get this
done. Yeah.
And just get into F1.
Yeah, I remember because his dad turned up, didn't he? With Jan Magnussen turned up with a film crew in tow, and they were filming the whole thing and stuff. So
I had Hugh there. He was filming it for me. I had my
Hey, I didn't even like to think what kind of phone it was that I had, but or I used your laptop camera or something to try and film some of it, or see how it all worked. But no, it was great. It was great fun. It was such a good event. I've been able to find it, so let me just quickly check to see if I can get it in full screen.
Here we go.
Now application. No, but
share screen.
Maybe it won't do it on that actually, because it's not going to let me do it because it's on a different. I'm using Chrome and I've put it on that on Firefox. I don't know what's happening.
Well, if you share screen, you should just be able to pick the screen.
Okay. Hang on. It might kind of. I'm not sure if that'll work. But let's see.
Share screen and then pick a window, and it'll come up. Should do.
If I go like that, is that going to work? It's not there now. I take it. No.
No.
No. Don't worry. It's not to worry. I'll try and. I don't want to end up blacking the whole thing out. But there we are. But it was very good. Sorry about that. I'll just cancel that one. Because it was fantastic to see everybody there and all, and people had come from all over the world to drive.
Yeah.
And so it was really, really good fun. It was quite a magnificent week to watch. Even just as someone coming along to support John and to watch it all, we learned so much. And it was the practice starts that I thought were the most dangerous.
And there we go.
Oh, yeah.
Third place in my first ever motor race. That was it.
Yeah.
And
you actually overtook Antonio for a second at the first corner. You got past him. But you kept him behind you for a few laps, mind you.
Yeah, it took him a little bit
of time to as you weaved across the road to keep him
alive. You know.
But
race him. I'd be if I'd been to the track beforehand, I would have won that race.
Exactly. We could have smashed it then, couldn't we?
Aye,
no. Next advertisements. Again, if only I'd got the sim track.
This would have been a podium.
You would have been Magnussen. Yes, you would have been now. Jan Magnussen.
I'd be for the arse right now.
I know.
K-Mag had finished the race and gone home by the time I came third. So halfway down the M1. Yeah.
But that's brilliant. We'll probably call it a day there, but stay on the line, Adam, if you can with us, and we'll finish the show there just now. But thank you to all our viewers and listeners will be on the podcast later on.
So I like this Tracy, she's nuts.
Is it a blackmail photo? It's on positive vibes here.
And you should have seen my mum driving to the shop 2 minutes before closing to buy some bags.
All right, she's describing how her mother drove to the shops 2 minutes before closing to buy cigarettes. That was it. Driving faster than any racing driver. But there we are. Well, thank you very much for joining us. To all our viewers and listeners, you've been watching the Car, Sim and Race Driver Show. And with me, Hugh Hattrick, with Andrew Marr, with Jonathan Sutherland, and of course, our very special guest, who unfortunately his screen has frozen once more. It is back again. There we are. Adam Croft, who's been with us from SimTrack. Make sure you go onto their website and see exactly what they do, because it's a fantastic experience if you're a professional and you want to get into racing, or if you're already doing it and you want to improve. SimTrack is the phenomenal place to go, and we thoroughly, thoroughly recommend it. But we'll end the stream there. Thanks for being with us, and Adam will keep talking in a wee second once we've closed the broadcast. But thanks to everyone.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. Thanks for having us on.
You're very welcome. Cheers. Drive fast and try not to crash.
What's that tree?